This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tan Talk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida. And we are having such wonderful weather, and I am so happy, and I am teasing my brother, who is in northern Michigan, who had snow the other day. Oh well, he loves it. But I'm glad I'm down here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, and I can talk to all of you about all of the wonderful books that I am getting and about intellectual property, because I am getting so many questions from my listeners because they've been writing books and they've been doing things and they want to know from Bill Larson, our legal eagle, about what in the world is going on in this world. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Patsy.
Okay. Well, I know Larson & Larson, your wonderful firm. You know, you do patent law because you're my patent lawyers. You do trademark law and, of course, intellectual property law because you are a member of Ape Law, which is the preeminent group that, is involved in intellectual property. But I've been getting, a lot of questions the past month. Ever since the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, registered to take a word. So my listeners want to know what in the world is going on with that.
Okay, so she has filed a trademark application for that word, archetype, and it is going to be a trademark that represents her podcast.
Which is supposed to start, I think, any day now. It's like, she got $200 million or something to do this podcast. And so that's
50 million pounds.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh. Wow. I love to think of that number. When I bought my house in England, it was 19,000 pounds. So, it boggles the mind. So the word she's taking is an interesting word. What does she?
It is.
Can you explain what it is and why she wants this word?
Well, I think it probably relates to her. If you look at the definition of archetype, I think it's an interesting word. Rolls off the lips easy. It's easy to remember. And I'm sure she had very good trademark lawyers screen it, clear it, and they feel they have a pretty good chance of getting it registered.
And it's actually a very archaic word. It's been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, like a lot of English words that go all the way back to Latin, Greek, English, Old English.
So what does it mean that she can trademark it? Some of my listeners have been writing in. So does that mean, it is not a word that is used a great deal. One doesn't hear it every day. Unless you read dissertations in college dissertations, I think are filled with it. All the MFA dissertations, they'll always talk about the archetype, the ones that are like the hero, all of this. So you don't hear this word every day. So what does it mean that she can take this word?
What it means is that if she can get trademark registration, that no one else can have a podcast with that word.
But just the podcast? Or
just
anything?
Podcast. No, just the podcast.
Just the podcast. So that's not taking the whole word.
No, it's supplying the word to a service, which is her podcast.
So she's trademarking that one particular word.
Yeah, so that'll be the name of her product or service. For example, Nike for sneakers.
And so that.
What does Nike mean? It's Greek.
But can people use that word? For example, now maybe people will write a book, the archetype of something, just because she's using that word. Will that be an infringement?
No. It doesn't remove the word from the dictionary or the language. It just represents her podcast. So as Nike represents sneakers, right? And what's the word Nike mean?
Yeah.
In Greek.
Yeah, so you can do it.
Victory.
Yeah, so you can just use the word and for your product.
Now Nike uses it for their athletic products and their clothing. Now, at some point, the trademark will become so famous that nobody else can use it for any other products. And Nike's an example. McDonald's is an example. Coca-Cola, Exxon.
Well, you know, one time years ago, I was writing something for kids about intelligent kids, you know, because both of my boys were in Mensa when they were 4 and 5 years old. So I was writing something, and I titled it Intel something. I don't know, Intel Geniuses or something. How to teach. I don't remember the title even. And I got a cease and desist from Intel.
Yes.
Yeah, because
it may have had a some kind of right.
Yeah, I was surprised because it wasn't about a company or anything. It was just about intelligent children. And so I never finally ever got that done because I was doing so many other things. But so somebody, like, if somebody does use it, they would send out a cease and desist.
Yeah. So if somebody else wants to use that word for a different product or, you know, in a different channel of trade, they can do that. She's just getting it for her podcast.
Okay. Well, because my listeners weren't sure and they thought, oh boy, you can register a word and it belongs to you. And I explained, I don't think it doesn't work that way. But of course, they are used to hearing words like Nike or McDonald's, and they think, you know, they can't use it.
Well, they can't use, you can't, some of them, no, some trademarks are so famous that nobody can use them. But in other cases, several people could use the same trademark, like Ford for automobiles and Ford for talent agency services. They're both famous. It's the same word, but they're in a different channel of trade.
So that's okay. Now, one of the questions that has arisen with my, you know, listeners who are a lot of writers, particularly the fantasy writers, they are writing books where they have specific names of characters that are distinctive, are very distinctive for, you know, for their book and also the title. I have one listener who's almost finished with a book that he's been working on for 4 years, I think. The title, the name on, you know, the first word of the title is a very distinctive made-up name, but it's actually very original. I had never thought of using the letters in the form that he did, and I think it's going to stand out. Now, when he registers the title of his book, can other people then use that word that he, it's just one of three words in the title of his book?
Well, first of all, you can't register the title of a single book. It has to be a series, like Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
So Gone with the Wind, right, was a single book. If I want to write a book, but it doesn't have the same content, and I want to call it Gone with the Wind, I can. There's no protection in just that single title. It'd have to be a series. So if it's just one book with that one title, it's not protectable.
So the key is, if he writes it now and then it takes him 4 more years to write a few more books to get the series, meanwhile, the word's not protected, so somebody could take it.
Correct.
Yeah. So either if he's going to get all sort of bent out of shape about it, he should just go ahead and write 3 books before he puts it out there.
Yeah, have the second one come along right after the first, and then you have registration, and then nobody can use that title for a book.
Ah.
But it has to be a series. It has to be more than one.
More than one. Okay, well, I think that will intrigue a lot of the writers who are listening to this program right now because more and more writers are realizing that it is almost imperative nowadays to write a series as opposed to a one-off, simply because it's so difficult to market books that if you have one-off, you have to market that book as you know, with as much power and vigor and passion as you do a series of books. So it's worth it to write a series instead of a one-off book, if you can.
Right. So what I tell my clients, authors, is that if you have a title, go ahead and file an application. And if it never comes out in a second series, then the application will go away after 4 years, a total of 4 years. And if you do get your second book out there before that, then we get the registration, and then you have the name of that book. No one else can use that title for your book.
Okay, well, that's good advice. People listen to this, because this is very important.
You can't protect the name of a song, the title of a song.
That's right. Wow.
So if I write a song, but it's not the same as anybody else, and I'm going to call Learning to Fly, I can do that, even though Pink Floyd and Tom Petty both wrote songs with the title of that particular name.
Yeah, this brings me to a question that my listeners also ask. They ask me, you're an intellectual property lawyer, and we know that so many intellectual property cases are solved really before they get to court. You settle them, you have these...
99%.
Yeah, 99%. You have these meetings around a conference table, and someone comes out a winner and someone comes out drained and ready to collapse.
They say sometimes it's better to smoke the peace pipe than make them war.
Yeah. But when you do...
People solve things.
But sometimes you have gone to court for intellectual property cases.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. A lot of times, yeah.
So the question that arose was from one of my listeners. They said, well, do you enjoy... Well, first of all, when you do take a case to court, do you prefer to have it ruled on by just a judge, or do you like to have a jury trial?
It depends what the subject matter is.
Do you find juries are more easily swayed on behalf of an author?
Not necessarily. I think juries are really smart, and 99 out of 100 times get it right. But in certain cases where you have highly technical data, it's better to go with a judge, because you don't have to spend as much time and money explaining it to the jury. The judge is obviously, going to be more attuned to the matter. What you typically want a jury is when you have an emotional case, because emotions can help drive up your damages.
Like if somebody steals a story from an author who's then broken
intentionally and with maliciously and hurts them, then you want a jury, because the jury's just going to whack them.
Oh, boy, I wish I had gone to a jury trial, because I was a pathetic person.
But they're
expensive. I know. That's my big intellectual property case. But I was so pathetic at the time. I would have broken their heart. I think they would have ruled in my favor. But unfortunately,
I had to collect.
Unfortunately, the lawyer I had... was 4 months out of law school, out of getting his license, and he was not up to going to battle with six corporate lawyers from a major studio. That would have been hard.
Thrown him into the alligator pond.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, what happened at that conference table? He was on my side. He was sitting next to me, and by the end of the conference, I felt like he was ready to just roll that chair over to the other side of the table, because I had no chance. But
I have certain cases. If there's a lawyer on the other side, I tell my client, you need to settle fast, because this guy wins all his cases.
Yeah, that's true.
There's some gunslingers out there that you just don't want to go against, because they're going to beat you, because they're great.
Yeah, especially like if they're from a big studio also like you. I'm sure people will shiver in their boots when they have to go up against you, because they know that know what the heck you're doing. This is an important thing.
Not so much, because I'm in a boutique firm, so the larger firms.
Well, yeah, you can't compete with Hollywood. Yeah, Hollywood lawyers are... Hollywood lawyers are something special. I mean, they really are.
I can't compete with the big New York firms, the big Dallas firms, the L.A. firms, the Miami firms. They just have so much depth, and resources, which in a boutique firm like mine, I don't have.
But the important thing for everybody is that when you do, and this is going to another subject that I've been getting questions about. Please, people, they have listened to me, and many of the listeners have come to me and said, you know, I get this email from a company, I get this request from a company to send them permission to do something with my book.
If it's unsolicited, delete it.
That's what I tell them, that's what you've been telling them, because that is not the way that the system works, right?
Yeah, those are often going to be scams. So I would do my research. Obviously, information and data is gold in business. And if you don't have your information and you don't do your research, then bad things are going to happen. You're not going to achieve your results. So do your research. And before you work with somebody, do everything you can to find out about who you are contracting with.
Because people on the internet, I mean, they hide behind so many shell companies. They hide their who is. They do so many things to, you know, get you all confused. They can have a beautiful website, but that doesn't mean they have anything behind them.
Correct. And so a lot of my work is due diligence. My client will say, hey, I'm going to do some business with this person possibly. Can you vet them out? And then I have my research protocols, and I can find out if they're for real.
And that's so important, and especially people should never just, you know, accept one of these invitations to submit their material, to give their material.
Never.
And
don't do it.
And then to agree to anything, because an agreement in an email is an agreement, right?
Yeah, an agreement by a handshake is an agreement.
So you cannot reply to an email, and if they say, we want to take your script and turn it into a major motion picture, you can't say, yes, go ahead. That's
unsolicited emails, delete those. Don't click on links if you don't know what they are. If you want to get your product out there, whether you know, it's a widget or it's a book or whatever it is you're doing, go out and do your own research. Hire a lawyer to help you or a person to help you do the research. Vet out all the good people out there that might be interested in your product, and then contact them.
That's the best thing to do. And don't give your credit card to let them direct debit you, because they send these scams. They say, oh, $34 for the first month. And it sounds really good. You know, we're going to do this or this for you for that amount of money. And people don't sometimes look that, yeah, you've committed to a whole entire year. And then you have to try to fight them not to take that direct debit. You know, then it turns into like $89 a month.
Yeah. So what you do is you just go to the store and get like a $50 Visa credit card that you can buy. It's only $50 on it. And use that.
If you're going to do something like that. But make sure before you do it, make sure that you're actually getting something for value, because so many of these companies, they actually don't have.
If it's $34, I mean, how much value can it have? I mean, that's the price of a hamburger and a beer.
Exactly. And in Hollywood, that means somebody can go to the Beverly Hilton and have one drink for $34.
Exactly. So, you know, if it's too good to be true, it is. That's the old saying. But the thing is you have to do your own research. Don't let them come to you. You go to them.
That's always the best advice. And, of course, we talk so many times, and people are getting smarter and wiser about getting their copyrights and doing things right, because it is important. And there is also this question of how you ensure that your copyright goes on in to whoever is going to come after you, right? You leave your copyright.
As soon as your work is complete, you know, if you're a painter and you put the brush down, or if you're a writer, you put the pen down or you stop typing, first thing you do is you bundle that up and send it off to the copyright office with your $50 file fee, and it takes about a year to go through, and then you get your copyright registration. Now you're protected. Now you're good to go.
And that's all you need.
For the whole world.
That's it.
File copyright in the United States, it's good for the whole world.
And how many years is it now?
100.
100 years. Okay, so that's
it'll be around after the author.
Yeah, exactly. So their kids and grandkids can enjoy it because that does happen, right?
Inherit them.
Yes.
You can inherit them, and then you can continue to collect the royalties.
And it happens that sometimes maybe your book might not be that valuable today, but maybe 50 years from now, it will be relevant.
It up and it takes off.
Yeah.
Wizard of Oz is an excellent example.
Exactly. Suddenly, boom. Oh, can you imagine inheriting that copyright? Wow.
Yeah.
So, it's so important. And for authors, I'm happy that our audience here, they have more and more understanding thanks to you. I get these really quick emails saying, what would Bill say about this? And I say, well, he said to do this, and he said to do that, because I want them to be careful and protect themselves and not get involved, because you don't want to get involved in a lawsuit or get involved in somebody, suing you, right?
Well, with the whisk of the pen, if you sign something and you didn't read it carefully, or you didn't have a lawyer help you, and you don't know you're giving away your rights, now all your rights are gone, and just by signing your name.
Exactly. And the important thing also is to think about what you put online. I want to always remind people, please be careful what you put. Now Twitter is coming back. What?
You can thumbnail it or watermark it so they can't reproduce it.
Exactly. And also what you write online on social media. This is something that you also have to be careful about.
Don't say anything bad about somebody else unless it's true.
And even if it's true, probably just keep your mouth shut.
Don't do it.
Because even if it's true, sometimes there's a famous lawsuit going on right now. The person might have said something true about the person, but decided to fight it.
You asked all the lawyers in the world, what is the one statement that is most used by all lawyers with their clients is, stop talking.
Good advice. Wonderful advice. Thank you so much. Bill, it's always a joy to talk to you, and I'm really happy that over this, it's now over 7 years that, I've been on Joy on Paper. It's really,
mm-hmm.
It's a miracle. And it's wonderful that you've supported me throughout this time and really, educated my listeners. They're so much smarter about things than they used to be, and they're very appreciative. I get these wonderful emails saying, I didn't do this. And I say, what didn't you do? I didn't sign that. I didn't send my entire book collection to somebody who's going to make me a famous, in Hollywood. They're learning, and that's a great thing.
Out to do, and I'm glad we've been successful, and it's just been a great pleasure. And obviously, I enjoy talking about intellectual property, and do it 10 hours a day, 6 days a week for 30 years. That's pretty much all I do, and I still love it.
Okay, well, that's the important thing. Always do the work that you love, and Bill Larson does. And tell them where they can find you and how they can contact you.
Best is LarsonPatentLaw.com, my website. Check me out if you want to have me help you with anything. Just there's a place where you can submit an email to me, and I'll call you back.
Okay. Well, Bill Larson, you are our legal eagle, and we appreciate you so much here at Joy on Paper.
Thanks,
okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. We'll go to commercials, and I'll be back with...
Actually, if you could give me a couple of minutes, my computer decided to reboot on its own.
Oh, well, Big Ed, that I can give you a couple minutes. We can we'll see if James Rowlands calls in. We'll just go straight to him, because this is exciting to talk to James Rowland. People, this new book of his is incredible. I'm just like, I can't believe it. It's so wonderful. And so you don't have to rush for me, Ed. How are you doing, Ed? Other than having a nervous breakdown because your computer's down.
Yeah, I'm just anxious to get it going.
Oh, well, these things happen, right? Like my printer.
Not often, but Yeah.
Yeah, you never know. Like my printer this morning, just when I wanted to print out a whole bunch of interesting things from this book, my printer didn't work this morning. So you never know. You never know. But I don't care. I like talking to you. All of my listeners, too, are always wondering about how you are. They say, what's Big Ed like? So I always tell them how sweet you are.
Thank you.
Well, can you imagine? It's 7 years. It's pretty good, huh?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like seven, but it's seven.
No, it is. It just seems like it was yesterday that I walked in here and I was so scared of everybody. And then, look, here I had Carol J. Perry on Tuesday, and she's up to book 12 in her Witch City Mysteries. And when I met her 7 years ago, she was just on book one, and I met her at my first writer's meeting I went to, and there she was, and she sort of very shyly showed me the cover of her book, and I thought, oh, that's a pretty cover. I want to read it. And I got it home, and my sister, Natalie, read it. And, well, we knew we had a hit, and I knew I had a hit when I read this book today. I am so happy to welcome James Rollins to the program. Hi, are you there?
I am indeed. Thank you very much. I appreciate the support.
Wow. Wow. I don't know what to do with you. You're so good. You are so amazing. You know, Kingdom of Bones is amazing. It's a thriller that I didn't expect. I mean, I always expect a great thriller from you. But this is a thriller on so many levels. There's so much in it. And I was actually, you know, a little bit hesitant. You know, we've gone through a pandemic, and I got this book, and then I started reading it, and I tell you, from the very first page, my hands started just trembling. I felt sort of almost like an electronic spark going through me, because I knew this book was going to be so great. And of course, it starts off in the Kasai district of the Congo. And when I started reading it, I really had no clue what I was getting into. And that first page is so, oh, wow. I can't tell people about it, but they have to read that first page.
Well, it definitely was, you know, I like to start my books out with a bang, so to speak, and then take my readers on a big roller coaster of an adventure. And you know, hopefully along the way, they'll learn a few things about history, about the area, about the Congo, and even about our current pandemic. You know, I have a what's true, what's not section at the end of the book where I pull aside the curtain and I reveal how much the book is real, where it came from, so in case any of the history or the science intrigues you, you can pick up those breadcrumbs and follow them.
Well, of course, this is book six in a wonderful series. But what I love about this book is that it has these levels. You have not just your story about really this horrible thing that's going on in the world, but all of the people, all of the, well, and a man and a dog story is always great.
Yeah, I mean, I do have a tendency to throw everything but the kitchen sink into my books. I'm always intrigued by, you know, interesting characters that I stumble across. I did a USO tour of authors to Iraq and Kuwait during the winter of 2010. It was just as the Iraq War was winding down. And there were six of us who went to 12 different bases. Now, me being a veterinarian, that was my official background, I saw these men and women working with their dogs, their military working dogs out there. And so being a veterinarian, I was curious, so I approached them. And I was like, you know, can I pet your dog? And they're like, sure, if you want to lose a hand, you can try. But I was really curious about that relationship between that dog and the handler. Did they just consider their dog like a sidearm? Or what was that relationship like? And so I interviewed them. I found out how deep that relationship was. And I knew I had to find a way of shining a light on that dynamic duo of handler and military working dog. So this book gave me a chance to sort of highlight that dynamic duo by writing scenes not only from one end of the leash, from the former Army Ranger side of the leash, but also at the other end of the leash from the dog's point of view.
I love that. I thought that was really terrific, looking at it from the dog's point of view.
You know, and I didn't want to do like a a Disney version of a dog that breaks out in song halfway through the novel. I wanted to make it authentic as I could. So I leaned on my, you know, background as in animal behavior from my veterinary years. I talked to handlers. I went to Lackland Air Force Base where they train the dogs to see how they work with the dogs, how they train them. So to make it as authentic as I can, because, you know, I wanted to try to take my readers, you know, put them into those the four paws of that unique soldier.
Well, you certainly do in this book. And, of course, this is, I'm sorry, it's Sigma Force. This is number, which number?
16. Yep.
16 of Sigma Force.
I'm believing that, too.
Wow. I know that, well, it doesn't seem like that. You know, when was the first one? When did the first one come out?
Because the first one came out in 2004.
Wow.
So it does seem like it's been a while.
Yeah.
Those that might be wanting to try jumping into the Sigma Force universe, you don't have to start from the beginning. I sort of tailor each book so it's welcoming to any new reader. Whatever backstory you need to know or any information about the characters, I'm going to give you in each book, because I always, at this point, I think I'm the only one that's read my books in order. I think most people just sort of stumble upon a Sigma Force novel somewhere in an airport bookstore, online, at an independent bookstore, and they just pick it up maybe because of the jacket, maybe because of the cover art, and then they read it. Because I want the series to be welcoming, so if you feel like jumping in with Kingdom of Bones, then feel free. There's no need to have read all 15 prior books.
Well, Kingdom of Bones, first of all, I will say the cover is beautiful. It's very dramatic, and the minute I saw it, I thought, whoa, I want to read that book. But Kingdom of Bones it's such a great title, because it immediately intrigues you what it's going to be about. And you have, here, the history of of Africa that you blend into this story, that is part of this story. But the history of what happened and how everything, really, all of this happened in Africa.
Yeah, I'm always looking for a historical mystery, maybe a piece of history that ends in a question mark, something I could maybe solve in the pages of the novel. So this, you know, the book brushes into the atrocities that occurred during King Leopold of Belgium's reign of Congo area. 10 million Congolese were slaughtered during that about a decade period of time. And I was really intrigued about the fact that it was a single black American missionary, Reverend William Shepherd, who arrived in the Congo. He was armed only with his faith and a Kodak box camera. He risked his life and the success of his mission to expose the savagery that was being committed there. So, you know, he was such a hero of the history that nobody really knows about. So I wanted to shine a light on him. So he's not only a hero of the era, he's a hero of my book.
Exactly. That is such a wonderful thing that you've done here, because people don't know about this history. And I think it is so important that we understand what happened, because then we can perhaps understand what's happening now and what has to be changed, the attitudes that have to be changed. And when you did something like this, bringing out Dr. William Shepherd, I think it's very important, historically speaking, for us to know about this man, because he was something really, someone so important, who, as you said, really shined a light on the horrors that were going on in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much there's that old adage that if you don't learn from history, you're due to repeat it. We have a, you know, periods of time of genocide, and it takes somebody to stand up and say no. Somebody, you know, whether it's a reporter or a journalist, because in my mind, besides being a missionary, he was a journalist. He was, armed with that box camera, taking pictures, and the pictures are worth 1,000 words. So he was able to expose what was going on there, you know, bring that light to the world, and it was that type of exposure that finally ended that reign of terror that was occurring in Congo.
And of course, you bring out the interesting and fascinating history of the Kuba people. Is it pronounced Kuba?
Kuba, yep.
The Kuba people, K-U-B-A. The Kuba people. What a fascinating history. And I was particularly enthralled with the story about the textile. I love that part where you write about
a particular textile. Explain about the Kuba people, because I think it's important that people learn about them.
Yeah, the Kuba people were a tribe. They were fairly isolated. They were basically not communicating to most of the world, but they were fairly advanced in their technology. Their society was very it was very open. It was very democratic. They were experts in metalwork and in textiles, much more so than a lot of their neighbors. And again, Reverend William Shepherd was the first one to make contact with them, and how he was able to breach that that feeling of we don't want to speak to anybody else that's outside of our tribe was he took the time to learn their language. And the fact that he did that showed that, you know, he was willing to learn from them. And he did. He was one of the first people to sort of be welcomed by that tribe, and it, to this day they revere him.
And when we talk about to this day, when you wrote this story, you started writing this before the pandemic, is that correct?
Yeah, I had come across an article in the New Scientist magazine. The title of the article was "When Is the Next Global Pandemic Due?" And this was an article that occurred in early 2019, a bit of a prophetic article. But I wasn't so much interested in the pandemic aspect of that article as I was interested in the fact that this article was talking about these virus hunters, these brave men and women that were going out to the field, to remote corners of the world, sampling wildlife, looking for that next pathogen, the pandemic pathogen out there. And what was intriguing to me, especially as a veterinarian, was that a lot of these virus hunters were wildlife veterinarians. So again, that intrigued me. So I pitched this story to my editor in the middle of 2019, said, yeah, this is fun story, write it. It was a big sort of jungle epic. We could have all this stuff about viruses and the weird biology of viruses, about virus hunters. And so I began writing the novel and speaking to virologists, speaking to medical doctors, speaking to evolutionary biologists. And I was about three quarters of the way through the novel when March 2020 came about. And I get another call from my editor, basically saying, did those virologists that you were speaking to in 2019, did they warn you what was going to happen in 2020? Now, they did not, but it was an intriguing time for me because, you know, I was hearing information from virologists both before the pandemic and the early months of the pandemic, and they were telling me things that I wasn't hearing. They were telling me things that was not being spoken aloud in the public sphere, whether it's public health experts or the government officials. You know, I was hearing one thing from them, but I was hearing something else entirely different from virologist. So I took a moment and I thought, I don't know if I should finish this novel. I don't know, being that my novels are meant to be big popcorn adventures, they're you know, big roller coasters of a ride, whether I should be doing that type of story in a time when you have medical doctors and nurses, you know, battling at the front lines, you've got families suffering from COVID. So I debated for a while, but the information I was hearing from the virologists was so intriguing and I think so important that I thought people need to sort of know what's going on, not only to shine a light on the current pandemic, but to give a little warning about what might come next, you know, how the world could better prepare for it next time. And there are a lot of information in this book, besides the big popcorn entertainment, that delves exactly into what's going on in the world of virology.
Wow. I think it actually came out at the perfect time because I was able to handle this in a way that I have rejected many pandemic books. I've rejected at least a dozen already. But this is something, it has everything in it. It's the thriller aspect, the team aspect, because you have your wonderful team of characters that your readers enjoy, you know, from Gray and Monk and Kowalski and Kane, and Tucker, of course. We have that, so we're going along with that, and then all of this other background information, and of course this, I don't know what to tell people what they're going to find, because it's sort of, I always love the reveal. And so as I said, when I started the book, and the first page, of course, starts off in 1894, and I wasn't sure what in the world I was going to get. I got to the Zappo Zaps. Oh boy! I mean, really, I was shivering at that first page. I didn't know I was so intrigued. And
I love that, you know, exposing the facts. Even in the Zappa Zaps, their story that you'll read about in the prologue is all true. Even Molimba, the cannibal that Reverend William Shepherd encounters and has a conversation with in that prologue, is a real historical figure. Molimba was actually head of the Zappa Zaps. He was a cannibal. So he is actually also a real historical figure.
Well, that's what's so exciting about it as I'm reading it. And I realized right away, of course, I knew some bits of this because I had been involved in writing a book that included Leopold. So I knew all about the king. I knew all about the Congo. As a matter of fact, when I was young, a girl, I wanted to go to the Congo to work as a nurse. So I knew the area and I knew the basic story. But as I said, with the way your deep understanding of the history of the area and all of the tribes and all that you bring in. So many of the parts that I want to tell people about of what they're going to discover, why they're there in the jungle, what's going to... I love the reveal. I will say I got to that moth one. There's a section there about moths. Now, when I was a girl, I was fearless, except for moths. I hated moths, and I lived in northern Michigan, and in the summertime, there would be these big moths. I could stand bats. I could take, bumblebees and wasps, but I had a real panic about moths. So when I got to that...
That's so funny, because my older brother, Doug, when he was a kid, we grew up in Chicago, and for some reason, he thought butterflies stung, and so he was terrified of butterflies.
Well, I don't know. I thought moths, I didn't know what they gave me the shivers. And so when I got to that part in the book, that's my worst nightmare.
Yeah, it was fun, again, being a veterinarian, to basically, to have this virus that gets loose in the jungle that begins to alter the natural order of things. It turns, men, women, and children this dull catatonic state where they can barely move, can barely speak, which makes them very vulnerable. At the same time, this virus is wreaking havoc in the biosphere, and it's making all animals and plants more predatory, more dangerous, more toxic. So it was a great deal of fun to be able to bioengineer my own sort of toxic version of these jungle animals. So it was a great deal of fun to write.
Oh, I can imagine. You came up with some doozy ideas there.
I'm always looking for that next idea. I always got my antenna up for that historical mystery or that bit of science that makes me go, what if, where's that headed? And then I try to find a way to cobble those jigsaw puzzle pieces together and build a big story.
Well, in all your books, of course, you are able to use this background as a veterinarian. You've incorporated things, but in this book, this really took off.
I mean, back when I was first writing, there wasn't a whole lot of animals in my books. It was only until later that animals begin to sort of pop up as sort of sidekicks to characters or whatever. And I didn't realize what was happening. It was a email from a reader who said, "Hey, Jim, I've been reading your books. How come, like, right here in your series of books, does everybody seem to have these animal sidekicks?" And I realized it was about that period of time where I stopped practicing veterinary medicine full-time and was writing full-time. And so that side of my brain that loves animals, loves medicine, loves science began seeping into that other half of my brain that tells twisted stories. And so there was no longer being able to be, the one side of my brain that loves animals wasn't being satisfied by my daily veterinary work. It ended up creeping into my writing. Because there's an old phrase, writers are naked on the page. We expose a lot more of ourselves than we think we do. And I think that's one case that proves that this gentleman could tell that there was some change occurred in my life when these animals started appearing in my books. And the change that occurred was I stopped practicing full time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the characters in this book, the ones that you're featuring, because I do want to talk about Tucker and Kane.
Yeah, Tucker and Kane, like I said, they first appeared in a prior Sigma book, it also appeared in a couple standalone novels. There are probably the characters that are closest to my heart because not only am I enthralled with the fact that this dynamic duo can function so well. But also it gives me a chance to, like I said before, to put myself into the shoes of that dog and try to take my readers and make them sort of understand exactly how impressive these dogs are. And when I first wrote Tucker and Kane in that first Sigma novel, you know, I vetted the story with some handlers out there, the military handlers, to make sure that what I was doing was accurate. And they were saying, yeah, you're doing a good job. But when the novel came out, I began getting feedback from readers saying, hey, you know, I like the book, but it seems pretty outlandish that Kane can do all the things that he was doing. I think, you know, you're overplaying your hand on what Kane can do. But what I was hearing from the handlers was, if anything, Jim, you're pulling the reins back on Kane. These dogs can do more than what you're demonstrating in that first book. So basically it's almost like truth is stranger than fiction, is that what I was, you know, was putting in the book was real and true, but it was seemed so fantastical that a lot of people weren't believing it. But as Tucker and Kane continued throughout future novels, I took a heed from those handlers and began sort of showcasing the true things that these dogs can do, their true amazing abilities.
Did you invent the word sub-vocalized? Sub-vocalized?
No, that's not my phrase. There is these microphones that allow you to communicate by just basically barely whispering, but it's picked up by a throat mic that can then transmit words quite clearly.
Well, you know, I think, as I said, a book about a man and a dog is always good. This is just the kind of book that people enjoy. And so we have that. And we have the other members of the team that you highlight in this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing that's fun about doing a series is that, you know, you get to bring in, you know, characters over the breadth of 16 books. That's one thing great about doing a series is that you can pull off things in a series that you can't do in an individual novel. Let's say Commander Gray, who's the sort of the head of the Sigma team sent into the Congo. Now, in the very first very first Sigma book, Map of Bones, he encounters this this assassin, and they get into a firefight. The assassin, Seishan, they almost kill each other. Now, by book 16, they're married and they have a kid. So it's hard to pull off that type of arc, shooting each other, trying to kill each other, to being married and having a kid, within one book. But you can pull it off over the breadth of a series. You know, it takes 16 books to get there, but eventually we get there. So that's one of the great things about writing a series, is that you get to this arc of characters that you can't achieve in a single book. So it's great revisiting the characters. I have Kowalski, who's sort of the middle of the comic relief of the story. He first appeared in one of my early standalone novels, but I liked him so much that I recruited him into Sigma. Then we have the new cast of characters that are presented in each book. We have a medical doctor that works for Doctors Without Borders. We have a biologist, a postgraduate biologist student who has Alzheimer's. And Alzheimer's has in the spectrum for autism. And it's pretty fun sort of creating these different characters besides revisiting the old characters.
Well, I think the book is great, and I love the author's notes at the back. They're very detailed, and I think they add so much. What you've done with the facts, you know, sometimes a book filled with lots and lots of facts can be very boring, but you have the great art of dialogue, and you manage to make everything interesting so that all along the way, you're reading dialogue, but it's just done so beautifully that we learn a lot. And then by the end of the book, we have these wonderful notes that put everything sort of clearly in focus, whether it's the origin of viruses, a search for viruses, and also about the Kuba people and about pygmies. But you've blended it all with dialogue, which makes it easy to read.
Yeah, my goal is I definitely want, the main goal of my writing is to entertain. You know, I want people turning pages late into the night. You know, if there are beads of sweat on their forehead, all the better. But I'm hoping that when you turn that last page and you close the book, that you're left with something to think about. And one of the greatest compliments I get as a writer is when a reader tells me, hey, you know, I liked that last book. It was really exciting. But, you know, I read those notes you had at the back, and I was really intrigued about that history, that science. And I saw that book you mentioned, or the article you mentioned, or that link that you put back there. And so I followed up on that. I was really curious about that topic. You know, then I know that the book worked on many different levels, not just the popcorn entertainment level, but had some resonance that raised some curiosity about topics that intrigued me, and hopefully they'll intrigue the reader.
Well, I do appreciate that. I love to have the author's notes like that, particularly where you do mention other books. And it was very funny that among the books that you mentioned, The Hidden Life of Trees, which I remember when I first got that book, I just fell in love with it. And I still have it on my shelf. And, of course, also Brilliant Green, The Surprising History of Science and Plant Intelligence. That's another book that I had read. And the third book I haven't read yet, but I'm going to read. And I love that you've put that kind of information in here. And there's things that people can Google. They can, you know, find out about the oldest virus. And they can find out about all sorts of things that they didn't know. And I know once they read this book, they will want to know about.
Yeah, my goal, like I said, is to first of all, get myself passionate about an idea. You know, I always tell whenever I teach writing that if a writer is not passionate about their work, readers can sense it. Readers have good noses on them. They can tell when a writer is maybe bored with their work or just going through the motions. So, you know, I've got to be excited about that history that I want to explain. I've got to be excited about the science that I'm bringing up so that when I'm that excited, hopefully it gets infused a bit into the pages so that when the reader, hopefully that will be a little bit excited about the same topics, okay, so then the back section offers them a little jumping off place to do their own exploration.
Well, I want to thank you so much. People, read this and read these end notes and find out something about Disease X. Oh boy, oh boy. Anyway, everybody, they will love this book. It's called Kingdom of Bones, and it is a real thriller by James Rollins. What is you have a website, of course, so.
I do. It's jamesrollins.com. It's sort of the encyclopedia of James Rollins. It's chock full of stuff about books, about writing, if you want to be a writer.
Everything you need to find out about James Rollins, because he is an author talented on so many levels. I just love it. I just love it. This is a fantastic book, a great read, and, you know, during the pandemic, I thought I would never want to read a book about something like this, but I found it, in a way, very reassuring to read this book. So I'm just very grateful for it, and thank you again for being on the program today. I think it's wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the support.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Wow. I ran out of time. I had to talk to him. This is an amazing book. Oh, wow. And anyway, I forgot, well, we skipped commercials, but Larson & Larson was on. And remember, solar energy, people, if you need to cut down on your bills and also make sure that you, you know, check your house for all of the energy that you are losing through cracks and windows and everything, go EHS. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. I hope his computer is up and running again. And yes, it is. And he saluted me. I saluted him. Everybody, check it out. Go EHS. Go solar. Bye-bye now.